MacCast, Monday, May 21st, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I have to be honest with you. This time of year, maybe not my favorite time for covering Mac news and Apple stuff, to be honest with you, because, there's not a whole lot going on. We're kind of in a holding pattern waiting for Worldwide Developer Conference, which is just a couple weeks away at this point, so we'd expect some big software and Mac OS announcements there, find out what Apple's going to be giving us next. I also have to admit that we're getting close to maybe a new version of the operating system, and I haven't upgraded yet. I am still rocking on my main machine, Mac OS Sierra. I just haven't had the time nor felt the need to upgrade to High Sierra. So I'll probably upgrade to High Sierra right before the new version comes out. So we will have some exciting news coming up, but this week it's not too bad. We have a few things to talk about. Unfortunately, we've got to talk a little bit more about security flaws and exploits and hacks and things like that. Few things in the iPhone realm to get into, maybe some new colors coming to an iPhone near you sometime soon. Tim Cook admitting some things about Apple's future plans, which is interesting, something that Apple doesn't talk about too much, and we'll get into what that means. And also, we have some HomePod rumors to discuss. And then where the good stuff in this show is in your feedback and things. I asked for your thoughts on the MacBook Pro keyboard, so we're going to get into that a little bit more. Had a question about how to clear the cruft off your Mac. We'll talk a little bit about a spring cleaning and your Macintosh. Get into that actually pretty deeply. And then a question about websites and security and certificates. And then I have some stuff to share with you about some wonkiness that I had with my HomePod this week. And that'll round out this episode. Probably not going to be too long on this one. And I think we're just going to dive right into our first set of stories. And we're kicking things off with an email security flaw that surfaced this week, although it turns out it's not anything really that new. I don't know if the exploit's new, but basically there is a PGP and S/MIME security flaw in the Mac mail on both your Mac and iOS devices, also on other clients, including Mozilla Thunderbird. I'm not sure how deep this goes, but the attack is called eFail, and it actually exploits some flaws that have been around in these email clients for almost a decade, apparently. Why this hasn't surfaced before or come out, I don't know, but this week it hit the news. And in order for this attack to work, there is a few things that need to be going on. The attacker first needs to have access to the original encrypted text from the sender's email, so they have to have access to that ciphertext from PGP or S/MIME. And then what they do is they take that little bit of text and embed it into an unviewable part. You may have heard the term in mail, multi-part. That's, I think, part of the MIME piece of this. So there's multiple sections or multiple parts of your email. There's the header, and you can have multiple sections. Well, you can create kind of a hidden little section that's not going to show up in your email. And so what they do is they take that encrypted text, they combine it with some HTML code, and they put it in that unviewable part of the email, and then they send that email back to you. And the reason they do that is in that little invisible HTML code part, they put in that ciphertext inside an image link or a tag, and then the URL for that tag that is hosting or serving up that image is actually a server that is controlled by the attacker. And so what happens is the recipient receives the email. When they open it up, it deciphers or decodes that ciphertext because, again, you're back on the original machine, so you have the private key that will decrypt that, and the plugin, the S/MIME plugin or the PGP plugin inside your mail client decrypts that and then, of course, sends that message back to the attacker server, right? Because it's going to request that image file. And so when it sends that request, in the URL is the unencrypted text of your email, the ciphertext. And so that's sort of how this works. And it can get delivered to the log files on that server, and then the attacker can look in their server log files, and lo and behold, there is that original ciphertext. So there's a lot of steps that need to happen for this exploit to be taken advantage of. But the point is that this shouldn't be happening at all. And it does affect Apple Mail on both Mac and iOS. Like I said, some other clients that are out there. And so what can you do to protect yourself? Well, if you're concerned about this type of attack, the best thing that you can do is stop using PHP or S/MIME inside your mail client. There's still standalone applications that you could use to kind of outside the mail client, encode the text and send it off. And then when you receive text back, take it out of your email, the encrypted text, and then parse it through an external program, and that will protect you. Of course, you could just stop using S/MIME altogether, but a lot of people like the security of being able to send secure emails. So basically, send and receive the ciphertext outside of your mail client until this gets patched up. And I would expect that patches are going to come pretty quickly for this now that it's out in the wild. But as I was saying earlier, it's still a little bit baffling to me why these things aren't patched really until they're publicly exposed like this. But that kind of happened this week. Again, not something that I think is going to impact a lot of you out there, but for those of you who do use PGP and S/MIME, I include myself in that little group. I don't use S/MIME as much, mostly the signing part of it, but occasionally I might want to encrypt something when I'm sending to certain people with certain kinds of data. So just something to be aware of this week. Another little exploit that popped up on my radar as I was going through news was something over on Apple Insider. They noted a new malware, something called MS Helper. And this one stood out to me because we've been talking about my issues where I was having the fans on my machine go crazy, my MacBook Pro, and also the processes. I had the main process. The kernel task for me was going crazy. Well, this little malware that has shown up, MS Helper, actually has a activity or a process called MS Helper that starts running on your machine and causes high processor usage, and that will eventually cause the fans to kick in and start going full blast. So if you have experienced this, and it's not some other reason, like in my case, it was dust just collected up inside the fans inside my Mac, and when I cleared that out, lo and behold, everything got better. But in this case, the MS Helper, it can cause problems on your system. So you can check for the existence of this running in Activity Monitor if you notice some of these symptoms. And it does appear to be installed via a Trojan. So some other application you download from maybe an unknown source or, you know, get off a torrent or however it might be, you end up with a Trojan installing this into your system. So as always, the best way to avoid this is be extra cautious about what apps you install, where you get those apps from, make sure you're getting them from legitimate sources, and be aware of what you're installing on your machine. You know, if you're just sitting there and you go to a website and suddenly it's popping up a request to install something on your machine, Be suspicious about that, and maybe read all the dialogues, make sure it's something that should be happening. But basically what this thing does is it installs a couple bits of software. So to remove it, what you're going to have to do if you do find it is you're going to have to go look for something in your launch daemons. So inside your system library folder, inside the launch daemons folder, you want to look in there. You also want to look in the system library application support folder and also the application support folder in your home folder for something that will say com.pplauncher. And if you see that in there, that is this. You can't just simply quit the process from the activity monitor because it will restart itself and keep running. So if you have been infected or impacted by this, that's how you remove it. And again, once again, it is called MS Helper, and that's the process that you'll look for in the activity monitor. And then finally, not something that's probably going to impact too many of you out there, but I found this story interesting from a cautionary tale perspective when talking about services that ask for or want to use your iCloud passwords. This week, an ironically titled service called TeenSafe was hacked, and they exposed unencrypted account information for iCloud accounts along with other data for their customers. So it was a service that claimed to be a, quote, secure, encrypted way for parents to track their teens' cell phone activities, including their messages and location data. So basically, a thing for spying on your teens if you are worried about what they might be up to, getting to read their text messages and stuff like that. Oddly enough, the service, even though it claimed to be secure, said in order to use it with your iCloud accounts, your iMessages and things like that, you'd have to disable two-factor authentication on your teen's phone. Why would they need you to do that? Well, because basically what they would ask you to do is give over your iCloud login or your teen's iCloud login. And then I'm assuming in the background they were using that information to just simply log into the accounts so that they could gather and collect text messages and the other data that they needed. Well, unfortunately, that stuff was being stored unencrypted inside some log files, and over 10,000 records were compromised. And those, in some cases, did include iCloud logins along with device identifiers for phones and email addresses for the parents. Now, luckily, none of the user-generated content was exposed in the breach, so things like photos, messages, and location data were not exposed. But once you have the iCloud login, obviously, there's other ways you could get access to that data. So really, really bad. And just serves as a reminder, you know, be careful about what services you're signing up for, especially if they're asking for logins from your other accounts. You really shouldn't give out your iCloud login to anyone or any service. I don't care how much you want to maybe spy on your teens or keep track of your teens' activities. It's just really not worth it. There are other ways to do this. There's great parental controls built into iOS and Mac, the Mac itself. And also, you can just simply, you know, ask to see your teen's phone and have them unlock it for you. I know in some cases they talked about, well, we can do things like the messages apps where they delete the messages. You know, if you have to go that far, maybe it's time to consider that there's other issues or factors going on here that you might have to deal with. And I know it's not easy. I'm a parent myself, so I totally understand it. But communication, I think, is really the key. And technology can help in some cases. And this time around, though, it really was not obviously good. So I guess, like I said at the beginning of this, cautionary tale, just be careful out there. And if you have any thoughts or opinions on this, certainly send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. The iPhone may be getting a little splash of color pretty soon, at least if you believe one analyst. And that's great news if you're a fan of the iPhone 5C. Rosenblatt Securities analysts, are thinking that Apple may bring back colors to the iPhone lineup this fall inside the rumored LCD iPhone. We've talked about the 6.1-inch LCD iPhone. It's supposed to be the entry-level or lower-cost iPhone in the lineup, which is that space that the iPhone 5C did fill. It's going to have pretty good specs to it, though. We've been talking about that a little bit. Basically, it's going to be a lot like the current iPhone 8 in terms, I would imagine, of its specs, but with a little more consumer-friendly design. And so the idea is that it would make the model even more distinct from the flagship model, so they'd be bringing back the bright colors. The piece says, including blue, yellow, and pink options designed to appeal to a, quote, younger consumer market. And that's a good thing, considering the fact that 82% of teens in the U.S. already own an iPhone, and 84% plan on their next iPhone purchase being an iPhone. This is according to numbers recently put out by a Piper Jaffray survey. So, you know, more colors, I think consumers really respond to those. Lower price points, consumers respond to that. And I think that is a great way to go with the next update to the entry-level version of the iPhone. So I'll be curious to see what Apple does. Right now, it really just does seem to be speculation by the analysts. They don't really have any kind of hard evidence or supply chain evidence to support that, but I buy it. I think that's something that Apple could at least be looking into and considering for an update, and I'd frankly like to see it. You know, what do you think? There's also some more information about why rumors around the update to the iPhone SE, the iPhone SE 2 that we've been talking about here on the MacCast for the past few months, are so hazy. You may remember that we've been talking about all kinds of different things with respect to the iPhone SE, that it might be more like an iPhone 10 in terms of the design, or it could be anything all the way down to and including just simply a small processor update and the addition of wireless charging. And the reason it's like that, according to Mac Attakara this week, is that Apple is still working on the iPhone SE 2. They aren't even into production yet. They just have a lot of prototypes floating around, and that's where a lot of these rumors are coming from. And again, I totally buy that as well. As far as what it's going to be and what it'll look like, I'm falling more on the camp that it's going to look more like the current iPhone SE, but with a glass back design, so kind of moving back toward the old iPhone 4, 4S designs where you had front and back glass. And that's going to enable the wireless charging features and then just a spec bump on the internals, but keeping the Touch ID sensor and pretty much very similar, if not the same camera system and all that sort of thing. So I think that's the way they're going to be going with an iPhone SE update, just because, again, that's really the entry level model for a lot of folks, and they're going to want to keep the price point down. And I, you know, to move to Face ID and the whole facial recognition system and sensors, that's going to add a lot to the cost. And I'm not entirely convinced that Apple would be able to pull that off and still keep the same price point. So that's sort of my thought on where that is going. Apple CEO Tim Cook was on the David Rubenstein show on Bloomberg Television this week, and he discussed a number of things from tariffs to immigration, but, you know, that's kind of boring in my opinion, so we're going to focus on what he said around Apple and entertainment, because that's something I'm very interested in. You know, what's happening with Apple's new original content series? Is that something that Apple's working on? What are they going to bring for us? And he, for the first time publicly, I think, confirmed that Apple is, quote, very interested in the content business and that they will, quote, be playing in a way that is consistent with our brand. So not a definitive saying, oh, yep, we're actually making some really cool original content with some awesome Hollywood people, but I'll take it. You know, he's basically saying, yeah, we're interested in playing in that world, and we don't have a lot to tell you right now. In fact, he said, we're not ready to give any details on it yet, but it is clearly an area of interest. So Apple is working on it. We've had enough rumors, and we know they're building this giant team in Southern California, folks headed up by a couple of former Sony executives. They've signed on a number of new shows that we've talked about, including stuff being produced by a production company run by Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon. They're going to be doing an Amazing Stories reboot with Steven Spielberg. There's a bunch of sci-fi series with you know, some of the people that were involved, and actually I think the main guy who was involved with Battlestar Galactica, which is an awesome TV show I absolutely loved. So I think they're going to make some really good content. And, you know, every time I bring this up, there's a handful of people that like to point out Planet of the Apps and Carpool Karaoke. Say what you want about those two things. Carpool Karaoke, very well produced. Both those shows, very well produced. Were they the right kind of content for a majority of people? Probably not, but I think there's some fans out there, and it was Apple dipping their toes in the water a little bit. So I don't look at those as an example of what Apple is going to bring us in the future in terms of original video content. And just based on the star power and the names behind, you know, what they are probably producing, I am getting pretty excited about it. Is everything going to be a hit? No, but I think if you look at even stuff that's being produced by Amazon and Netflix and HBO, not all that stuff is really hits either. So there's going to be hits, there's going to be misses. We just have to wait to see what Apple does before we actually judge it. And I think there's a lot of people judging them prematurely based on a couple of little shows that they produced for really the Apple Music service. So this is a very different animal, And again, Tim Cook this week kind of confirming that Apple is working on that. Another thing he did in that interview was also share the latest Apple Music subscriber numbers. He says that Apple now has 50 million, excuse me, paid subscribers, and that Apple is adding about 4 million new paid subscribers each month to the service. And that's 4 million after they account for the folks who drop off and then add new people. So that's 4 million new people per month. So Apple Music growing at a very good clip. And that is good for Apple's services business, which has been doing very, very well. Are they going to catch up to Spotify? No, probably not. Not anytime soon, although they are gaining ground, to be honest. So that's another comparison that people like to throw out there. As is always the case with stuff that Apple does. You know, I think Apple does things in their own little vacuum. They don't really worry too much about what their competitors are doing. I'm not saying they totally ignore it, but it's certainly not their focus. They're really focused on creating a great music service and signing up subscribers who are in the Apple ecosystem and building on that. And with numbers like this, I think they're proving that they're doing a very good job of that. And then finally, in the entertainment stuff, one show that will not be coming to a new Apple TV subscription service is The Obamas. They had been shopping around and looking for a place to create shows, and they were in talks reportedly with Apple and Netflix, both the companies vying for the opportunity to work with The Obamas, and it looks like Netflix has won. They have a multi-year deal they announced on Twitter to produce original films and series with President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama. Details of what those shows are going to be were not really shared, but Netflix did comment that they could include both scripted and unscripted series, as well as documentaries, features, and more. Thinking about that, I think that pretty much covers just about anything. So we don't know what they're going to be making over there, but they're not going to be doing it at Apple, unfortunately. And Apple is selling HomePods, despite what the media and analysts and some blogs and services out there might want you to think, that the HomePod is tanking, despite what your non-Siri assistant-loving friends might say to you. Strategy Analytics did some number crunching. They did their thing. They analyzed the first quarter of sales of the HomePod, and they think that Apple has sold as many as 600,000 units. Now, that's not blazing a trail or, you know, rocking up the charts or anything like that, but hey, it's not bad. You know, it might not seem like a lot, but it's certainly not a bad start. And Apple historically has a pretty good track record of slow starting on products and then ramping up quickly and eventually dominating. We saw it with the iPod, we saw it with the iPhone, we've seen it with tablets and other things. So let's give them a little bit of time to work in here. It's a first generation product, and they have a lot of room. They've given themselves a lot of runway, I think, to improve and iterate. And frankly, we'll talk about this a little bit more later, I still love mine. So if it is accurate, and again, I'm saying that because Apple doesn't give their own official numbers, so this is Strategy Analytics just doing what they do and analyzing different sales data and trends that they look at and coming up with this figure, not definitive. But if it is accurate, that means in just a few months, Apple has already captured about 6% of the global smart speaker market. And that, again, if you want to compare them against Amazon and Google, not a huge number, but again, I don't think that comparison is really right, because Amazon sells a wide range of speaker products. They've had a longer lead time than Apple. You can get anything all the way down from a cheap little $49 thing up through something nicer and more expensive, right? And they've also partnered with other companies to build in the Amazon Alexa technology. So, that's not really the right comparison, I think, to make. And 6% of the global smart speaker market with a speaker that really isn't a quote-unquote smart speaker, it's really a high-end speaker with smart features, that ain't too shabby. And also considering the fact that we're talking about the global market, and to date, Apple has launched the HomePod in as near as I'm counting, just three countries. So as they expand, they're going to be selling even more. So don't count them out just yet, and they seem to be off to a pretty decent start. Again, I'm not going to say an amazing start, but not too shabby, Apple. And there is a rumor that Apple has been looking to produce a cheaper version of the HomePod. We've been talking about that a little bit on the past couple shows. Something in the $199 range versus maybe the $329 US dollar range that they're in now. Well, this week, little information was added to that. There was a rumor floating around out there that Apple was going to do the lower cost version of the HomePod, but they were going to put it under the Beats brand. In my opinion, I don't think that's happening at all. If Apple is going to put out a cheaper version of the HomePod, and frankly, I don't think that's something that's even going to happen this year. I think they eventually will, as they do with all of their products. They expand the lineup as the product matures. So we'll get a lower cost HomePod at some point, not this year, and it's not going to be under the Beats brand. So why are we hearing this rumor this week? Well, it's likely that, you know, Apple is getting ready to release and put out AirPlay 2. They had already announced that they were going to add an AirPlay 2 speaker to the Beats lineup. HomePod is going to have AirPlay 2 support, so I think we're getting some crossed signals here. Really, rumors overlapping each other. Again, people are looking at the supply chain. They're seeing Apple putting in orders for speaker parts. Apple owns the Beats brand. It's very likely an updated Beats speaker with AirPlay 2 support that is coming, and the $199 price point would fit into some of the other things Apple does in the Beats lineup. So I would expect a new Beats speaker coming out this year at $199 with AirPlay 2 support. And that's probably what's going on there. And then one last thing related to Siri in the rumor mill this week. There are some sites reporting that if you ask Siri, "Hey, lady, tell me about WWDC," that she will tell you that she's getting a brand new voice or that she's going to have a shiny new home. Well, one that's not really shiny, but more meshy and matte. And that's causing some of the rumor sites to kind of conclude that, hey, maybe there's going to be some Siri HomePod updates at WWDC this year. Well, that may happen, but it's not because you were tipped off by the current version of Siri, because if you have a good memory, you might remember hearing these phrases or similar phrases from Siri before. That's because these were the things that she was saying last year before WWDC Worldwide Developer Conference 2017. And the reason she was saying those was because she did get a new voice in iOS 11, and also it was when Apple announced the HomePod and that it was coming. So I think I tried a few of these today and they weren't really working. She wasn't divulging any information. So I think what happened is maybe a developer forgot to remove some of last year's witty responses to the "tell me about WWDC with Siri." So that's likely what was going on, and it's not really a tip-off of what's going to happen. We still have plenty of tip-offs of what might happen at Worldwide Developer Conference this year, but I'm not expecting any hardware announcements. That all seems to be coming in the fall. I'm not expecting any computer updates. I'm not expecting a bump to the MacBook Pros, because I think Apple is waiting on newer processors from Intel so they can use the faster or the lower power DDR4 RAM so they can get past that 16 gigabyte RAM limit on the MacBook Pro. So not really expecting much hardware stuff. I think it's going to be very much software focused. Expect to hear things around Xcode and new APIs, and also get more information on what the next version of iOS 12 is going to look like, and the next version of macOS and what that's going to look like. So I think Apple's going to stick to a software focus, and we just have a couple weeks to go before we actually know for sure. So with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. If you have any feedback on any of this stuff, of course, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and this week it is Small Dog Electronics. Look, you know, you have a lot of choice on where to buy your Apple stuff, but unfortunately, fewer and fewer of those choices are with companies who really know Apple and Apple products, and that's why I love having Small Dog Electronics as one of my sponsors. They have been around, like many of us, through thick and thin, through the good and bad of Apple, and they are our community. You know, they started in a garage over 20 years ago, and they haven't stopped offering great deals on Apple gear and technology to the community. And the best part about them is you're buying from folks who know and care about this community, real folks, and not some nameless megacorp. So now is actually the perfect time to visit smalldog.com, because you got graduations coming up, you got Father's Day right around the corner, and you know, I know Dad wouldn't mind having a second HomePod from Small Dog. Maybe I need to say that louder so my family can hear me. Yeah, I wouldn't mind one, and Small Dog is a great place to get a HomePod. Also, they're offering up some deals. They have a deal on an Apple Watch, which would be great for a dad or a grad. They're offering a $10 off an Apple Watch band with the purchase of an Apple Watch with AppleCare Plus. They also are offering up a free printer when you buy a new Mac with AppleCare Plus and a backup drive. And if you're having a hard time deciding on a gift, well, they posted some new accessory bundles to the website. That makes it easy to find the perfect gift for any Apple fan. But you have to visit smalldog.com to check out these deals. And be sure to check the website early and frequently this weekend, because they're about to have their famous garage sale event that's going to be happening over Memorial Day weekend, and they have a bunch of exclusive and special deals and stuff that they're going to be throwing up on the website, and those things sell out really quickly. So you're going to want to hop on to smalldog.com and check those things out. And lastly, because you're a MacCast listener and because they love this community, they gave us a coupon code. Use the code MACCAST at checkout, and you're going to get $20 off your order of $100 or more. And yes, that code, it will work even on the bundles that I just told you about. So really great deals over there. Just make sure you visit smalldog.com, and don't forget to use the code MACCAST, and tell them I sent you, and tell them thank you for being a sponsor of the MACCAST. We love having them here. All right, I brought this up on the last show. We were talking about the MacBook Pro keyboard. Of course, there's now a class action lawsuit. This is the new keyboard, the one with the butterfly mechanisms, and many folks have been having issues with it. If it gets dirt under it, maybe even a little bit of dust, sometimes the keys can stick. And I just didn't feel, frankly, that maybe it was a big enough problem to warrant a full class action lawsuit or a recall. Some people are saying Apple needs to completely go back to the old keyboard. There's no way the new keyboard can be any good. And I asked you, you know, what do you think? Is this a problem? Those of you out there who have the new MacBook Pro, the 2017 with the new keyboard, how do you feel about it? And at least one person wrote in and felt that I was really being an Apple apologist when it came to the keyboard, and that this was a serious design flaw, that there's too many people reporting issues with this keyboard, stuck keys. I've heard it from people. I'm not denying that the issue exists. It definitely exists. I just don't know that it is as ramped a problem. And so this person felt, hey, Adam, you're doing the whole Apple apologist thing. You're letting them off the hook too easily, and this is a big problem. Now, oddly, this person didn't own a new MacBook Pro. He was just basing his opinions off reports. And I'm not saying that that isn't valid. I just need you to have all the facts when we're talking about this, because still, many of you did write in to say that you had at least one, if not multiple, units replaced or keyboards replaced on your MacBook Pro. And that definitely is enough for me to say that there are some issues with at least some of the keyboards. The question is how rampant that is. How widespread is that? And to be honest with you, I think this is more widespread than some other hardware issues that we've talked about in the past. So there's definitely something going on here. Is it an inherent and systemic flaw that can't be dealt with or that can't be handled without a full recall or a full, you know, going back to the old style keyboard? I don't think so. And that's kind of my point. Like, I don't think this is as bad as many in the media want to make it out to be. It certainly is a weakness in this design. It does appear to be more susceptible to dirt and dust. And several of you have reported that you had small issues that were resolved simply by following Apple's instructions in their support article for kind of cleaning out the dust and grime that are under the keys, using a can of compressed air, holding the MacBook kind of upside down at an angle and spraying compressed air under the keys to clear out any debris that might be under there. I had at least one person write in to note and say, hey, I didn't even have to go that far. I've had a key get stuck now and then. I just end up tapping on it repeatedly in succession to kind of unstick it, and then it's fine for a while. My guess is that maybe what's happening is debris has gotten under there, and by tapping it multiple times, you're kind of pulverizing or breaking down a crumb or something that might be under there, maybe dislodging it, and then the key starts to work. So you probably still want to use the compressed air thing to make sure that it gets out from under there and doesn't build up again. So I think it's kind of a buildup over time of dirt and dust. And by the same token, though, I also had many of you write in and say, you know what, I've had mine for a while now. I've had no issues with it. I've had no stuck keys, no problems. So, you know, we have kind of both sides of that coin, and that's exactly the point, is I don't think this is as bad. And many people said that they did, when they did have a repair, they didn't have any issues after that. So I tried to follow up with many of you who said, you know what, I sent mine in because I had the problem. I had this key or that key that stopped working or got stuck down. Apple sent it to the repair depot. I got it back. And 100% of the people who said they had to have it sent out for repairs said it was repaired very quickly. They had it back sooner than expected. Apple usually tells you 3 to 5 days. Most people had it back within 2 days. And I can tell you from my recent battery replacement experience on my MacBook Pro, that turned out to be the case as well. I thought I was going to be out without my machine for 3 to 5 business days. I actually had it back in like a day and a half, really, when you talk about the total time, which was just amazing. So Apple support has been really good in dealing with the problem once people have contacted them. But what I wanted to follow up on was, you know, after the repair, have you had problems with it? Because there's been this rumor, and I have heard through the grapevine, that Apple did some adjustments and made some tweaks to the internal design, and the newer machines and replacement keyboards aren't as susceptible to this problem. They're not 100% immune from what I understand, but maybe not as susceptible. And almost everyone that I talked to who had the repair done, with one or two exceptions, said, yep, I have not had the problems come back. So, you know, I don't have proof that Apple has redesigned the keyboard. That's all hearsay. It's rumor. It's conjecture. But it does seem to be proving out, at least in our little MacCast community. I still have emails coming on this, so I'll keep following up with it. But again, I don't think it is a long-term systemic problem that Apple cannot overcome. I do agree, though, with Renee Ritchie that the keyboard itself and the keyboard redesign itself is very divisive. There are a lot of people who love it. There are a lot of people who hate it. And there really is no in between. And so the dilemma becomes, if you have such a divisive keyboard design, should you go back to the original one? Because nobody seemed to have a problem with that. That was not dividing the market up into the people who like it and don't like it. I don't think anybody was really complaining about the old keyboards, at least not too much, not to the degree that people are complaining about the new keyboard. And the point behind that is that some people are saying, hey, I'm not going to buy a new machine because I hate that keyboard so much. Now, I will tell you, if you're in that camp, I had a number of people who wrote in and said, I started with the new Mac keyboard and I hated it. But over time, I've grown to love it, and I actually like it more than the old keyboard now. So it may be the kind of thing where you have to, like, grow into it. And there's a lot of Apple products that I've had over the years that are like that, that from day one I didn't really think were great, but grew on me. My Magic Trackpad is probably a great example of that. I figured mouse all the way forever, and it took a while to kind of get up to speed and get used to the trackpad, but now I wouldn't have any other kind of input device with my Mac, at least until Apple tells me the next thing, which is probably VR or AR or some sort of voice thing. But for now, I like my Magic Trackpad. But it did take some getting used to, and I think the new MacBook Pro keyboard, for a lot of folks, that is the case, at least from what I'm hearing from you. I don't have a new one, so I haven't had that experience yet. I played around with it at the Apple store. I'm kind of in the middle on it. I could go either way. I think, again, I'd have to use it for a long time before I could really form an opinion. And I think a lot of people just aren't giving the new keyboard design a chance. And I think you kind of have to do that before you totally dismiss it. And again, I was hearing that from a number of people in our community saying, yep, that's how it worked for me. So there you go. That's kind of my thoughts on it. I'd love to hear now your opinions on this idea that maybe Apple should go back to the old design just because the new MacBook Pro keyboard is so divisive. It's really dividing the community up a little bit. But Apple, you know, for their part, I'll tell you, I don't expect Apple to do that because Apple never looks backwards, right? They are classic for thinking this is the right way to go moving forward. We're going to stick with it. We're going to keep iterating and improving on this. And so I fully expect them to overcome any of these issues and get through it. So that's what I'm thinking. Let me know what you're thinking. MacCast@gmail.com. It's probably later at this point than spring, but we're going to talk about spring cleaning on your Mac. And I'm bringing this up because I've had a number of people write in lately to ask me, I know, what do you recommend for kind of keeping my Mac up and running, keeping it in tip-top shape? What kinds of apps and software are you using? What are the typical maintenance things that you're doing? And can you run through that stuff? And I do this every year around this time, sometime between January and June. We'll call that spring, right? No, not really, but okay. Just between you and I. And these days, I have to honestly tell you that I'm finding, really, I'm having to do less and less other than keeping my software up to date, running software updates. I don't have to really run a lot of utilities. It seems like the Mac seems to do a lot of its own maintenance and management on its own. I'm not running into beach balls all that frequently. Now, I do have a newer machine with an SSD, and I think that makes a huge difference. So one thing, I guess this doesn't really fall in the spring cleaning camp, but if you have the capability or ability to upgrade your Mac's internal spinning hard drive to an SSD drive, that's the number one thing you can do to get your Mac running faster, hands down. And I know I resisted on that for a long time, but I'm converted. You know, I've seen the light. Praise be to the, you know, flash storage gods, whatever it might be. It is definitely the way to go. So if you're dealing with a lot of beach balls and you're using a Mac with a spinning drive, and you can do that upgrade, I would consider doing that first and foremost before anything else. Now, if you just want to clear off the cruft, if you just want to get in there and clean things out, maybe see if you can get your system running a little bit faster, give it a little bit of a tune-up, there are some things that you can do. And the first thing that I will say is if your computer seems to be running fine, you probably don't need to do anything. You know, perform these tasks that we're talking about. They're not going to hurt anything if your computer's running fine, but you don't really need to run them. So this is for the folks who are maybe getting beach balls where it feels like your Mac is running sluggish, and maybe you're already running an SSD and you have plenty of RAM, or you're just not ready to upgrade to an SSD. So the first thing I would try is try and figure out the reason why your machine might be running slowly. And we've talked about the methods for doing this on the show in the past, but we'll just run through them real quickly as a refresher. Look in the typical places, check activity monitor, you know, sort by the CPU usage, sort by the memory usage, and do this when you start encountering beach balls. You've been working on your Mac, you're doing the normal things that you might be doing throughout the day. Run Activity Monitor at that point and see what's using up my memory, what's using up my CPU. And you might be able to identify a single background application or something that's running that maybe you don't need anymore or you can clear out. So start to clean out any old stuff that could be running in the background. And so you want to look up in your menu bar there and look at what's in there. Am I using everything that's sitting in my menu bar? Can I shut some of that stuff down and only run it when I need it? Can I get it off my computer altogether? Look in your system preferences and look around, especially at that bottom row of system preference panes, because those are the third-party things, stuff that's not part of the native operating system. Do you need all the stuff that's down there? Should that be running? Take a look at the login items. So again, go into the system preferences, go into your users and groups, and look at login items. What things are launching at startup? Are you still using all those applications? Do those applications need to run at startup? And if they don't, go launch that application and turn off the auto launch, or, you know, just inside the user and groups, the login items, you could also remove the item from there. So get rid of some of the stuff that might be running in the background, eating up your system resources when you don't need them to be eating up system resources, right? So try that. Another thing you can do is think about when was the last time you did a clean install of the operating system. If you've been doing over-the-top upgrade, over-the-top upgrade, over-the-top upgrade, which those work great, and many of us fall into that pattern, right? There's nothing wrong with your machine, so you just keep doing an upgrade. And if you've been doing that for 5, 6, 7 years, maybe it's time to do a clean install. Get rid of a lot of that old stuff that may be clunking around inside your system folder, right? A lot of times that stuff doesn't go away. It just sits there. And most of the time it sitting there is not a problem. It's benign, but we build up so much stuff over the years. Maybe it's just time for a clean install. And I've covered how to do this. So go back and listen to prior episodes of the MacCast. Of course, first and foremost, before you do a clean install, backups, right? Make sure you have 2 backups. Confirm those backups are working. Please, please do that, because the minute you erase your internal drive to do the clean install, if you only have 1 backup, you don't have any backup anymore. You've just gotten rid of your backup. So I know it is a pain in the butt to do a clean install, and many of us, myself included, I don't like to do it. Again, I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm not running High Sierra yet. You know why? Because I'm due for a clean install. I've got to do it, and I don't want to set aside the time, but I know I have to do it. So eventually I will get to it. I will do it. But if you have your backup, especially a clone backup or a Time Machine backup, you can use Migration Assistant to still bring back a lot of your data. This is probably the biggest question I get asked about a clean install is, do I have to like hand copy over everything? I used to fall in that camp. I don't anymore. I use Migration Assistant usually to bring back my user data and my settings. And then what I do is I clean install all of my applications from scratch. And what's nice about that is it forces you to do that kind of house cleaning and decide, do I really need this app? Do I really want it back on my system? And then the other thing a lot of people worry about is email. In this day and age, most of us are using IMAP accounts for all of our email. If you use IMAP, your email should be up on the server. So the minute that you put your accounts back in your settings, all of that should sync back down. And again, that's going to kind of clean up your mail libraries and all that stuff. So it's a good kind of house cleaning to just do a clean install if you have not done that in a really long time. But let's get to kind of the meat of this question. You know, what kind of maintenance and utilities and stuff do you use to kind of clean out your Mac and get it running in tip-top shape? And the first thing I would look at is, how full is your hard drive? You know, if it's getting really, really full, there's a lot of things that can often have to write out to your drives, and having a full hard drive, it'll just start to slow down. There's having to move a lot of data and files around on your system, and that will make your Mac feel sluggish. It's one of the reasons why replacing a spinning hard drive with an SSD works out better, because it's not having to grind so much. But if you have a really full hard drive, cleaning that out, getting some headroom or some extra space on there can be a good thing. And so to do that, what a lot of people really want to do is identify and archive any old stuff that you might have on your disk. So if you've got, you know, go in your documents folder, go in your pictures folder, go into your video files. Do you really need all that stuff sitting right there immediately available on your boot hard drive? Chances are there's a lot of stuff in there that you don't. So move that stuff to externals or internal drives if you have a little hard, what I call a hard drive toaster. I use one from Anker that's really great. This is the thing that's got slots. You can plug in a external drive or an internal drive, rather a bare internal drive. You can mount it on your desktop and you can move files over to that and you can archive it. You could use a network attached storage drive or a RAID drive connected to your Mac for external storage. I have a couple of Drobos that I use for that, but you could use a Synology or, you know, insert your favorite external drive there. Of course, you can use just plain external drives. USB thumb drives are still valid, depending upon the size of your files, but you can get some pretty good deals on some pretty large flash or thumb drive storage, and you can put your stuff onto there. And I will just say, if you are archiving stuff, moving it off, and it's really valuable data, like your photos or maybe your business files, consider making two copies, right? Have two copies just in case one of those archives, you go to recover something, you put it in, and you discover it's got data rot or some sort of corruption on it. You want to have an extra copy maybe sitting there just in case, because these are archives, right? The whole point of archives is stuff that you want to keep. Of course, as you're doing this process, you might run across old files that you're like, why do I have this stuff on here? I don't need this anymore. Just dump it, right? Throw it out, get rid of it. So just clean that stuff off. A lot of times what you want to do is, when you're doing this, is you want to find not only old files, but maybe the large files, the big files that are taking up a lot of space on your system. And there's a few ways you can actually find this stuff. Actually built into macOS Sierra and High Sierra, if you just go into the Apple menu about this Mac, click on the storage tab. It now has its own built-in storage manager. So pull that up, click on manage, and then you can choose documents in the sidebar, and it's going to show you three different tabs. It's going to show you your large files. It's going to show you your downloads, so stuff that maybe you downloaded, you installed, and maybe you don't need anymore, and it's going to give you a file browser. And in the file browser, you can hover over an item to see a magnifying glass icon to actually go and find where it will show you that file in the Finder. There is also in this view a little X button, and clicking on that will actually delete the file out of the Finder. Just be careful with that one because, you know, clicking delete will erase the item. It does confirm that you want to delete that item, but it's going to delete it right from there. And so for me, that's a little bit scary because I lose the reference of if it's just a file name. Sometimes I might have files in multiple locations and maybe I want one in a certain place, but not the other. So just be careful with that feature. But built right into macOS, you do have a file manager where you can locate old and large files. For me, I like to run a third-party app. I use Clean My Mac from MacPaw Software. It does a number of different things, but one big feature is the ability to remove old system junk, cache files, old mail attachments. It lets you review all that stuff, so it does a little scan, finds things that it thinks, hey, you can actually remove this stuff. You really don't need it, but you get to review it manually, and then you can remove that stuff. Built into that is also a large file utility that helps you find large or outdated files and also outdated apps. I use it a lot to find apps that I've installed on my system that I just haven't opened in years. And it's like, okay, why do I still have that on my system? Let me clear that out. And it does have an app uninstaller. So it will go through, it'll get all the little bits that are in, you know, the application support folder and the preference panes folder and all of that stuff and remove everything all at once. So I love Clean My Mac 3. Some people will sometimes complain because it does install some things that run in the background. I turn all of those off because I just run clean my Mac manually every couple months. I don't need to have it constantly monitoring my system, and I just don't like the overhead that that adds. It's not necessarily bad. It does pop up a little alerts, and I find those to be, you know, kind of annoying just for me personally, but some people like to have those little ticklers and reminders, and you can configure all that stuff as you want, but it is turned on by default, and that will sometimes put people off a little bit. I've even had people say, well, you know, people at the Apple store told me it was bad to run because it was going to slow down my system. Not true at all, at least not in my experience. But if that bugs you, go ahead and turn that stuff off. Another great app for finding and dealing with large files is Daisy Disk. I own this one as well. It gives you a nice little visual graph that will show you where the large files are on your system, and you can drill down into these kind of, it almost looks like the sectors on a hard drive. It's really, really cool, colorful graph, and it's a more visual way to kind of drill down and find your larger files, and I like that one as well. So Daisy Disk is another good one. And then a big culprit in taking up storage and some files that you probably don't need lying around anymore are iOS backups. So check inside iTunes for maybe old iOS backups. I've found ones for devices that I sold off a long time ago. And, you know, I buy larger devices, 128 gigabytes, 256 gigabytes. Those backups can be that large or big chunks of that. So go into, you know, launch iTunes, go into the preferences, click on the devices tab, and you'll see you can get a list of all your local iTunes backups and the dates that those backups were made. And you can select any old ones you no longer need, and you can click delete backup. Now, I will tell you, sometimes I have found backups that were not showing up in that iTunes interface. So you can look directly in your Finder, in the your home folder, in the library folder, inside the application support folder. There's a folder called Mobile Sync, and inside Mobile Sync, you'll find a backup folder. And sometimes you can find old backup files that are not showing up in iTunes. Just be careful there because they have kind of cryptic file names. So make sure you understand what you're deleting before you delete it, and maybe even make a backup of that backup before you delete it, or an archive of it just in case something goes wrong and you need to get that back. But Clean My Mac also has the ability to find those old iOS backups and recommend that you remove those as well. So I usually grab those when I'm running my Clean My Mac scan. So there you go. That's how you can get rid of some larger files. Oh, and then one other thing with respect to larger files and kind of clearing off the hard drive, you might consider moving your larger library files off onto an external storage or maybe up into cloud storage. If you do use cloud storage for your libraries, say like your photo libraries or something like that, just make sure that is not your only copy, that your only copy of your large library files, like your photo library or your music library, are in the cloud. Make sure that you're using maybe a syncing service and that you have a local or an archive or a backup copy of that. Because if you don't have a local copy, it's probably not getting backed up by things like Time Machine. Don't just store it in the cloud, I guess is what I'm trying to point out. That is not a good solution for clearing things off, even though Apple seems to want to do that with their new documents in the cloud feature, something that I'm not, you know, desktop and documents in the cloud feature, something that I'm not overly a huge fan of, letting the system manage that and delete your local copies and only keep copies up in the cloud. Just that, I just don't feel safe with that. You know, I trust Apple a lot, but I guess I just don't trust them that far. But that's just me personally. But certainly for things like your photo library, don't have your only copy of your photos be up in the cloud somewhere where you don't have local access to them should something go wrong. But I will tell you, as far as local libraries, I keep my iTunes library on a USB external drive, and it's worked out really, really great for me, especially since I now have Apple Music and iCloud Music Library, because in the past, the dilemma would be, well, what happens when I take my laptop on the road? I have to take the external hard drive with me if I want access to my library. Well, now that I can stream my movies from iTunes, all the stuff that I've purchased from iTunes, and I can get access to all of my music with iCloud Music Library on the go, I don't have to really worry about that too much. So, you know, my local copy that gets backed up sits here on an external hard drive. It's not taking up space on the internal drive on my machine, and that's worked out great for me. My photo library is not large enough that I need to move it off quite yet, but I'm getting there, and eventually that may end up on an external as well. Another thing you can do with your photo library, if you want to clean it out a little bit, is maybe split it up. Again, archive some of your photos. Do you really need to have every shot that you've ever taken, especially like burst shots and things like that, stored locally on your drive? Probably not. You can create extra photo libraries and archive those off onto external storage. A great tool for doing that is Power Photos from Fat Cat Software. So check that out. That can help you split, manage, and merge those extra library files. Of course, you can also do it manually. You can export the photo originals from the photo application and then hold down the shift key when you launch Photos to create a new library and import your exported photos into those. So kind of break things up manually, and then you can archive and back up those old libraries. And then if you ever need to view them again, you can just open them up from the external. You can literally hold down the option key when you're launching Photos, and you can select a photo library from anywhere. You know, it could be on your NAS drive or wherever you want to access it from, and then go back, go into Photos, access all the photos from there, and then switch. You can move back and forth. But again, if you're going to be doing that a lot, I recommend looking at Power Photos because it's a really handy utility for doing that. The only thing you need to know about if you're using iCloud Photo Library and you're going to split up your libraries, your photo libraries, you can only have one system library. That's the library that syncs with iCloud Photo Library. So that should be your main library. Keep all your favorite photos and the photos you want to always have access to, you know, in that one main library. And like I said, split off maybe some of those archives and stuff like that. So I know a lot of people who do that, and that works out pretty well. So there you go. A bunch of different techniques for cleaning off and clearing off your hard drive. The last little bit of housekeeping stuff that I want to talk about is more in the kind of running maintenance scripts, clearing caches, rotating log files, all those sorts of things. Again, my favorite tool for that, CleanMyMac 3. It has all that stuff built into kind of a single application. I also use Cocktail from Maintain. That is a great bit of software for running those. It does cost, and so if you want a similar functionality, but you want it for free, you can check out Onyx, which has been around for years. And just make sure you get the version of Cocktail or Onyx that's appropriate for whatever version of your operating system that you're running, because they are tweaked to be operating system specific. So they'll have a Mac OS High Sierra version, they'll have a Mac OS Sierra version, whatever one you might be running, you want to make sure you grab that one. But those are great utilities too, and I run those occasionally. If I'm starting to see beach balls, you know, I'll clear out the cache files, I will rotate the log files, I'll let it do its thing. A lot of that stuff should happen automatically on your Mac, and like I said, it's got your Mac has gotten better and better at doing those things. But occasionally you might want to do that manually, and these are great tools and utilities for doing that. But there you go. That's kind of my tips on doing spring cleaning and maintenance on your Mac. If you have anything that I missed, let me know about it. Is there some little trick or tip that you have that I didn't cover? Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Here's a little Safari security thing that came up from Randall. He emailed me this week and he said, you know, I've been noticing lately that I'm seeing a lot of security pop-ups, or seeing security pop-ups more frequently on my Mac as I'm surfing the web in Safari. What I'm getting is sites that are notifying me, hey, this site certificate is not valid, and it kind of blocks you. We've seen this message before, right? It says, hey, this site's not secure, it's being blocked. And he says, you know, I go, I check the certificate. It seems like it's legitimate. It's a good signing authority, a company like VeriSign, somebody to be trusted. And he does the right thing by kind of pausing and going, hey, is this right? Checking the site certificate before proceeding. So that's the first thing that I recommend is, you know, make sure, hey, this is what's going on. And don't just click the, hey, continue on to the website anyway, because there could be a man-in-the-middle attack going on or something could be happening, right? That pop-up alert is coming up because the browser is trying to protect you. It's noting there is a problem. But more and more frequently, this is coming up and it seems to be false positives. And that was kind of what's happening to Randall. And he's like, why is this happening? This does seem to be valid. It seems like I can go there. I know one thing that can cause those certificates to pop up is if a certificate is valid, but it is expired. And believe it or not, sometimes even the best sites forget to renew. I think this has happened on different areas of Apple.com or sites owned by Apple where they forgot to renew a security certificate and suddenly you're getting security pop-up warnings inside Safari. So that's probably the most common one that I'll see on legitimate websites. So, you know, just be aware of that. And if it's just an expired certificate, it's generally pretty safe to continue. Hopefully the website will update their certificate. And you may even want to shoot them an email to their support and say, hey, I saw this. You maybe take a screenshot and show it to them and say, hey, your security certificate is expired. You probably want to update that thing. But the other reason I've noticed this happening a lot more is because Google changed their rules about how they're doing indexing and what it takes to get better rankings and indexing on Google. And one of the things that's recommended and they give preference to is sites that are using HTTPS or SSL all the time. So they want everybody to be using secure connections all the time. Well, the trouble is that many websites, or a lot of websites, don't fully understand what they need to do to implement SSL all the time. They know that they need to get a certificate. They know they need to install that. They know they need to force your browser over to HTTPS if you come over and you're not in the secure protocol. But the problem is that if there are ads, if there are images, if there are scripts that are referenced from that site in the code that aren't also being pulled in via HTTPS or SSL, you get a security warning. And it says, hey, this page, not everything on this page is encrypted. Now, I noticed the latest version of Safari, at least with respect to images, what it'll do is it'll still load the page. It won't give you the security pop-up, but it'll block all of the images that aren't coming in HTTPS. So there's that going on. There was also a change to Safari, both in iOS with 11.3 and macOS with 10.13.4. I'll link to Apple's support page on this, but Safari now checks if a website is asking you to enter a password or credit card information on the page. And if it's doing that on a page that's not secure, not using HTTPS, then it will pop up that security warning and say, hey, this site is not secure. Do not enter your information. Do not put your logins in on that page. And so that's popping up a lot more. And it is kind of common, especially on smaller websites, to see them have login forms, especially that maybe aren't under HTTPS. So you're going to have to make a call there if you feel secure and safe entering your information. The problem is that if it's not HTTPS or SSL, your passwords are being sent from your browser to that server in the clear. So if there is a man-in-the-middle kind of attack going on, somebody could sniff and maybe see your login credentials and get access to that. So Apple advises, hey, if you do run across this, contact the site and let them know once again their page is not secure. My guess is they'll likely know already, but it doesn't hurt for you to remind them, hey, you probably want to get this behind HTTPS and use SSL on these pages like this. So Randall, that's a number of the reasons why you're seeing those pop-ups more frequently. Basically, the browsers are just getting more insistent that HTTPS and SSL is used, and a lot of websites are still kind of learning exactly what it takes to actually do that and what that all means. And, you know, we're humans. We make mistakes, and so people miss things. Things happen. And you might see those pop-ups from time to time. But you're doing absolutely the right thing by staying diligent, by when you see that pop-up, reading through it. And that kind of brings up the follow-up question that Randall asked me. He says, you know, if we're seeing more false positives like this, more pop-up dialogues that, you know, are warning us about something, and it turns out that warning is not valid, doesn't pop-up fatigue become an issue where you start to go, okay, I see this all the time. There's nothing wrong with this. Go ahead. Just connect. I don't care. Stop bugging me. You get that pop-up fatigue. And I say yes. I firmly believe that this kind of added security can actually lead to less security, right? You get so frustrated and bothered by this stuff that you just start to ignore it. And you go, I already know what that is. You know, there's nothing wrong here. Just let me onto the site. That's when people get bit, though, unfortunately. So we need to stay diligent, even in the face of pop-up fatigue. I know it's annoying, but read those dialogues. Make sure you know what you're clicking OK to. Make sure that you understand what it means when you say, OK, I recognize I just put in my username and password. You're telling me this isn't secure on this website, but go ahead and do it anyway. You know, be aware that you could be opening yourself up at that point. And make that decision informed. Don't make it casually just because you're tired of seeing the pop-ups. So, it's ultimately not a good thing to have too many pop-ups going on. So stay vigilant, and I think we'll all be safe for it. So that's my advice, and that's why I think you're kind of seeing what you're seeing. All right, last thing that I want to talk about is some wonkiness. I think I mentioned this at the top of the show. Some weirdness that I had go on with my HomePod, and I absolutely love my HomePod. I use it to listen to music every day, and a lot of music. I'm requesting all kinds of different things from Siri, and what happened to me was suddenly the HomePod started to play only parts of albums or playlists, or in some cases, I would ask for a playlist to be played. She would respond and say, yep, I'm going to play this playlist. And then nothing. I had no sound. Nothing was happening. And it got to be very frustrating. And I think it started out where a playlist would just kind of end early and then slowly degraded into fewer and fewer songs inside a playlist. And then some playlists not working at all. And it was, at first, I didn't think anything of it. I thought maybe network issues, or maybe they're just having issues on Apple servers. And then it got to the point where I had this one playlist that I kept requesting, and it was like, yep, I'm going to play that playlist, and I had no sound. And I thought, okay, something really is going on here. What's going on? And unfortunately, the HomePod being somewhat new and not a ton of people, I think, having HomePods. I mean, there's a lot of people, but it's not like a Mac where I can go on, I can Google a problem, and there's like, you know, 10 articles that tell me what the answer to that problem is. I searched for this with the HomePod. I didn't find anything. And so finally, I thought, you know, I'm going to do the obvious thing. I'm going to turn it off and turn it back on again, basically restart it. And the way you do that with a HomePod, as near as I can tell, maybe there is a restart. I guess this is the other thing I should research, a restart command. But I just unplugged it from the wall, waited a few seconds, plugged it back in, and lo and behold, boom, it was fixed. It was able to play the playlist that I was trying to play. No problem whatsoever. So I don't know what went on there. I don't know what happened, but I was curious if anybody else out there with a HomePod has run into this issue. Feels like a software bug to me more than anything else, and just kind of resetting the memory or maybe the cache or something like that. I don't really know why it got working again, but it worked. What was even weirder about it, in my opinion, was some playlists would work. Some playlists would play only a few of the songs in the playlist. So if a playlist had, you know, 20 songs in it, it might play 4. And then other playlists didn't work at all. Really weird bug. Don't know why, but I thought I'd mention it on the show today just in case somebody does know what's going on there. The other little bit of, I guess this is more frustration that I'm having with HomePod, because in general, I love, like I said, the HomePod. I use it for tons of stuff. It works really, really great. But this one little thing is something that I feel like should be in the HomePod. It's feeling like it's not in the HomePod. And I thought, maybe I'm missing something here. And it has to do with reminders. I will ask the HomePod to set or add a reminder, a timed reminder. So do this thing and remind me at 3:00, or do this thing and remind me in a couple minutes, in 5 minutes, that I need to go do this thing. And the HomePod will happily say, yep, I've added that to your reminders to happen in 5 minutes or in, you know, at 2:30. And that time will come and I will get an alert on my Apple Watch. I will get an alert on my Mac in terms of a notification, but nothing from the HomePod. And I guess I was expecting that if I ask the HomePod to set a reminder and I give that reminder a title and I set it for a time, that at that time, the notification would come audibly through the HomePod. And a couple of times I did get an automated response, but I think what happened was it just set a timer rather than actually adding a reminder, because I didn't get any vocal response of, hey, Adam, here's your reminder to do, you know, ABC. Here's your reminder to take out the trash or whatever it might be. So any ideas on that? Am I just missing something, or does the HomePod not have that functionality? Maybe that's something that'll come up at Worldwide Developer Conference this year. And hopefully, if I haven't missed anything, Apple does add that improvement so that there's more of an audible reminder of reminders coming from the HomePod. But like I said, overall, I'm still loving the HomePod. One issue that I am having with it is it's almost too good, to be honest. What I mean by too good is I tried to ask my iPhone a question. So I gave her a Hey Lady question from the living room of my house, and the HomePod responded from my office, and the two are pretty far apart, and I wasn't even talking that loudly in the living room, but the HomePod responded, and unfortunately I can't hear her response from that distance, right? I didn't know what was going on, so I ended up having to actually manually activate Siri on my iPhone to get the request taken care of. And that has become kind of one of my biggest sources of frustration, even here in my office. If I do want to use Siri on one of my other devices, I have to kind of be a lot more deliberate about it. And that's a little bit frustrating. It's more of an annoyance than anything else. So I either have to manually, raise my wrist so that my Apple Watch is active. And that works all the time. If the Apple Watch screen is on, it's going to take the Hey Lady command first and foremost over any other device that might be around. Beyond that, it's the HomePod that's always responding. If I want my iPhone to work, my iPhone 10, I figured if I held it up and it was at attention, I was looking at the sensor, that the iPhone would take over the command, but that hasn't been the case in my experience. The HomePod will still try and handle that request. The only way I can get it to work with my phone is to actually hold the button and actually manually activate Siri, and then it's not a problem. The only reason this is a big annoyance is, of course, the HomePod that has some limits, right? It can't do all of the Siri requests that my other devices can. And so when I'm really trying to process a request that only my iPhone or Apple Watch can handle, it gets really frustrating when the HomePod chimes in and then says, oh, I can't do that, right? So first world problems, right? This isn't really a huge issue. And I have no doubt that these instances of confusion and things like that are going to improve over time. Apple's going to get better at this. Again, HomePod is a first generation product. So I'm not really worried about it in the long run, but I just wanted to talk about it on the show and find out if some of you in the community maybe have some workarounds or have found some ways that you can work better with the HomePod and multiple devices in the same room, or the HomePod activating from really far away across the room when you don't want it to. So if you have any tips or tricks related to HomePod, please send those in, mattcast@gmail.com, or you just have comments, questions, or opinions about the HomePod, send those in as well, mattcast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do have a couple quick items of housekeeping. First and foremost, don't forget MacStock 2018 is coming. This is a great conference put together by Mike Potter. You can check it out at MacStockConferenceAndExpo.com or just MacStock2018.com. I mean, check out this speaker list. Well, of course, Adam Christensen from the MacCast is going to be speaking there. So I would love to meet you. This is a great opportunity. It's in Chicago. I guess I should mention, or just outside of Chicago, in Woodstock, Illinois, in July, actually July 21st and 22nd. So just about a month away as I am recording this podcast. And like I said, a lot of great speakers there. Myself, I'm going to be doing a thing on Markdown, how I discovered Markdown and how to use Markdown and what apps I use and stuff like that. But the speaker list is amazing. You got Wally Cherwinski, you've got myself, David Ginsberg, Kelly Gaumont, Gene McDonald, Chuck Joyner, Guy Searle, Tim Robertson, Allison Sheridan, Mike Schmidt, and Brett Terpstra. I mean, that is a who's who of really smart people. This year's conference, all about productivity. So if you're at all in the area, if you can get out to the area, I really recommend you going to a MacStock. It's a lot of fun, and there's a lot of opportunities in and around the conference to just meet with people, have conversations, and just check out the schedule, MacStockConferenceAndExpo.com. And you can still get early bird pricing for the full weekend pass for that conference by using the code MACCAST. So use the code MACCAST. You'll get a discount on your tickets, and I look forward to seeing you there. I hope to see you there. The other bit of housekeeping I need to ask you about is the MACCAST forums. I am going through a thing where I need to do some changes to the MACCAST servers. I'm trying to maybe cut a little bit of the server costs, save a little bit of money. And a lot of you are not hanging out on the forums. There is a great core group of people hanging out there, but I'm kind of feeling like maybe we've moved on to other places. So what's your opinion? Do we leave the forums up and running? I like them there. They're not too much of a burden to run, but again, it is another thing that sits on my plate that I have to manage. I have to order the software. I have to make sure the software is up to date and secure and all those sorts of things. So it is a little extra overhead for me. And if folks are feeling like it's not a resource that we really need, maybe it's time to send those out to pasture. I don't know. What's your opinion? MacCast@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about that. And then another thing somewhat related to that, although this is more of a change or a move. This has been happening for a while. A lot of you know this already. I am moving the MacCast member program over to Patreon. So patreon.com/MacCast if you'd like to directly support the show. And that I am going to have to be shutting down. And that's mainly because as I move to this new server, I also need to upgrade the server software and the operating system that's running on the server, and really the PHP version that's running on the server, and the software that I use for managing the MacCast membership site, the version that I'm on. I could get the new version, but because we're moving to Patreon, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to get the new version. Basically, that software is not going to run on the new servers. So it's much easier for me to manage the program and do offers, and I can have a lot more flexibility with Patreon for sharing exclusive content to supporters. And so we're going to be winding down and shutting down the MacCast member site. I already sent an email out to everybody who still is a MacCast member, who's still on that program. If you are a month-to-month subscriber, the best thing you can do is go in, log into your account at member.maccast.com and cancel your subscription. If you don't do that, I am going to be canceling the month-to-month subscriptions at the end of the month. So those will be shut down. And then once you've canceled, you can just pop over to patreon.com/MacCast and sign up over there. If you're a 12-month or 6-month member of the MacCast, you're actually absolutely fine until your membership ends. Those subscriptions, memberships don't auto-renew, so they will just naturally expire. And you don't have to move to Patreon now. You can if you want, but I am going to try and figure out how to continue all of the benefits for both groups. And no matter which side of the program you're in or on when we do this transition, I'm going to try and make sure that you have access to all the exclusive content and the podcast feeds and all that stuff to the best of my ability. I'm still working out some of the nuances of that. The one thing that I may not be able to offer is access to current MacCast members to the stuff that I post, the Patreon exclusive posts. Patreon has these Patreon posts, and I can't, unfortunately, manually add people to Patreon. You actually have to sign up and be a recurring supporter on Patreon for me to get you in there. So the way I may handle that is figure out some way to cross post that content in an area where only MacCast members have access to. I just haven't figured that part of it out, but I'm going to do my very, very best to make sure you have access to all of the benefits while we're in transition so you don't miss out on anything. So don't worry about that. If you have any concerns, of course, you can always just email me, MacCast@gmail.com. Ask me any questions you want. I am open for that, but just wanted to make sure everybody was aware. We are moving the membership program. We're going to be winding down and shutting down the old software and moving over to Patreon. So if you're in that group, just be aware of that and check out patreon.com/MacCast to sign up and become a Patreon supporter. All right. Speaking of supporters, let's talk about one of our show sponsors. I want to thank Smile Software for their support of the MacCast. They make great applications like PDF Pen and Text Expander, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with Text Expander for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You will find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. Keep your emails and audio comments coming. You can send those to MacCast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. That is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.